Well, perhaps one of the reasons we think satisfaction and fulfillment and meaning in life eludes us is that maybe we lack the resources to really find out about anything long enough. Maybe we think that more money would satisfy, but I'm not going to get enough to find out. Maybe we think that the perfect job would satisfy, but we don't know where it is or if we're qualified for it. Maybe young, single guys, you think that the perfect girl would satisfy, but you're not good looking enough to get her. Maybe we think fame would satisfy, but we don't know what to do to get famous. And so, like Mick Jagger, our actions and our hearts constantly sing out, I can't get no satisfaction. Part of the problem, as I said, is that maybe we don't have the resources, the time, the mental capacity, the energies, the financial abilities to pursue something all the way to the end of the road. And so we get maybe a little bit down the road. And we give up and we go to another road for satisfaction and fulfillment, wondering if maybe if we had gone just a little bit further down the road, there would have been satisfaction. There are many roads. And we jump the roads like wanderers and travelers all the time, wondering if one will be a short road and we'll find the end and the fulfillment soon. Wondering if we have gone halfway down several roads and there would have been fulfillment if only. Well, what if we could get counsel from a guy who had gone to the end of every road? What if we could get counsel from a guy who had the ability, the mental power, the financial resources, the time and energies to not just go down one road and give us some counsel about what it's like, but to go down the many roads of joy, of pleasures, of the meaning of life? Well, we can. His name is Solomon, and he writes to us from the book of Ecclesiastes. Turn there with me in your Bibles, if you would. Just about to the middle of your Bibles and take a right. Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes is a book of wisdom. And it records for us this thing of the meaning of life. It scratches this itch that we're all so familiar with, or maybe not familiar enough with. Maybe, as we said earlier, the busyness of life has either pointed us to ask these greater questions of why we're here, what it's for, and what we're supposed to do. Or perhaps the busyness of life is a way that distracts us from really getting to the meaning. And so the loud car radio, to the loud television, to the noisy kids, to the busy office, is all a very convenient distraction where we never have to think long and hard about why. The book of Ecclesiastes has 12 chapters, and we'll look at the first two today as we start a 4-week series. The first two chapters have three sections to them. The first is something of an introduction telling us the who and the what. Verses 1 and 2 of Ecclesiastes chapter 1 say, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities," says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The who is the teacher here. The Hebrew word behind teacher or preacher in the New American Standard is koheleth. Koheleth can be translated many ways, something like the sage, the preacher, the teacher, the instructor, even the leader of a ceremony, in a sense. And so this is who comes to counsel us. He comes with a lesson, but he doesn't come as an inexperienced teacher to us. This guy is in complete authority to be telling us about the end of the roads, we could say. He's the son of David, inheriting the kingdom of Jerusalem and Israel at the height of Israel's blessings. He's given wisdom by God in some sort of supernatural way. He uses his skill, his financial resources, and his wisdom to not haphazardly find out about fulfillment and the meaning of life, but to carefully and almost scientifically run down these roads, examining, questioning, and drawing conclusions in various areas. His conclusion is stated right up front. The teacher in verse 1, but verse 2 tells us his message. The message is vanity of vanities. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Vanity of vanities doesn't mean so much looking in the mirror as much as it means just emptiness. Some translations may have meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. But in trying to define meaningless, we're kind of scratching our heads wondering what the meaning of meaningless is. Actually, Solomon has meaning here for us. Actually, Solomon has a message here for us. But his message is not nothing, nothingness. His message is not meaningless, meaningless. His message is that there is emptiness, that there is futility, that there is, as he describes it five times in the book of Ecclesiastes, groping after the wind. You try to grope after the wind and you come up short. You don't get any. And that's Solomon's point here. Right up front, we already know it's going to be somewhat of a pessimistic look on life. Which leads us then to his pursuits in the second section of this book. As I said, he used his wisdom to draw this conclusion in a way that wasn't haphazard, but it was careful, even scientific. So these pursuits that he'll unfold for us are careful pursuits, meticulous pursuits. His first is the pursuit of something new. Verses 3 through 11 of chapter 1, Solomon unfolds for us something new. We see that in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 1. We see where he's going in this passage, that it's a pursuit of something new, but his conclusion is, that which has been is that which will be, and that which has been done is that which will be done. So there is nothing new under the sun. He asks, is there anything of which one might say, see, this is new? Well, it's already existed for ages which were before us. So we know that's where he's going. We know he's headed to conclude that there is absolutely nothing new under the sun. But verses 3 through 8 now unfold for us several things that aren't new. Several things that are not just not new, they're also a part of this redundant cycle of futility we call life. In verse 3, it's work. What advantage does a man have in all his work? He's talking about the fact that you work, and guess what? Tomorrow there's more work to do. You actually never get it done. You get through today's to-do list, there'll be a new to-do list tomorrow. Half your work is maintaining what you've already done. Half your work is fixing what you messed up and trying to work. And so even this idea of work is this futility, this emptiness, this it never gets done. Where's the end in sight? He's trying to paint the picture of completion and fulfillment for us. And in doing so, it's not just work, but he says in verse 4, it's generations. One generation dies, another one springs up. This has been going on ever since the beginning. Kids have grandkids, have grandkids, have great-grandkids, and eventually they forget. Eventually there's this new cycle of people, and if it weren't for history books, nobody would care what has already happened. And so, generations is this other thing of constant cycle of futility. And of course, we realize he's looking at things somewhat pessimistically. We know as Christians, the Bible does have an end in mind. That it won't be an endless cycle of generations. But it does remind us, yes, this thing of life, where's it going in my generation? What's the purpose of me being here? How important am I when another generation springs up tomorrow? In verse 5, we see it in sunrises. The sun comes up, and guess what? It goes down. This has been happening ever since the beginning. The waters, in verse 7, waters go up into the air with evaporation, and guess what? They rain and they come down. The wind in verse 6, it blows eastward sometimes, and you think, oh, maybe the part of wind in this whole equation is that it blows leaves eastward. The goal is to get leaves eastward. Oh, no. Wind also blows westward. It stirs them up that way, too. And so it's again scratching that itch of the meaning of life and what this is all here for. What we are here for. We see it perhaps best in verse 8. He says all things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. He says the eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Remember, this is in the context of the search for something new. When he says the eye isn't satisfied, he's talking about eye candy. And I don't just mean women. Eye candy is anything that is appealing to the eye. And for sophisticated people, that's fine art. And for us regular old people, maybe we look at the 2005 Mustang and say, yeah, that's really cool. The front end is that kind of retro look. Looks like a 67. And you go and you look at it again and again. You pull a magazine off the shelf and you look at it again. It's enjoyable to the eye, and there's nothing wrong in that. But what you need to realize is that you used to think the 86 Mustang was nice. Now it looks a little ghetto. The ragtop's a little rough. Muffler's dangling a bit. And even back, you know, in 86, if you today had a pristine, perfect condition 86 Mustang, you've seen it. It's not all that appealing to you. There's something about the eye seeing something new. And so you redecorate your home and you look at magazines about new homes. And the newness of seeing is there because the eye is not satisfied, nor is it in the hearing. You get a new CD. You're glad Norah Jones came out with a new CD because the first one was great, but eventually you're wanting something new. There's some enjoyment in a CD that might last months if you get a good one. But then eventually there's this unfulfillment. I just hate my CDs right now, maybe we say to a friend. And we go out and we get a new one. Well, it reminds us of Ecclesiastes if we're thinking through things. The seeing is never fulfilled. The hearing is never fulfilled. And so the conclusion is that there's nothing new under the sun. The new thing will not satisfy. Secondly, he pursues wisdom. There's the pursuit of wisdom in verses 12 to 18. His wisdom is a seriously pursued wisdom. It isn't that he started with a bachelor's degree and said, you know what? I've done the education route and it doesn't satisfy. That's enough for me. Remember, he's gone to the end of all of these roads. He's not dabbled in pleasure. He's given himself over to pleasure and fulfillment, trying to find the answers at the end of the road. And so he pursues wisdom with all of his heart. And notice, too, that this is a God-given wisdom. Look at what verse 16 says. I said to myself, behold, I have magnified and increased wisdom more than all who were over Jerusalem before me, even David. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and knowledge, and I set my mind to know wisdom, to know madness and folly, and I realized that this also is striving after the wind. We won't look at it, but you can note 1 Kings chapter 4, which describes Solomon's wisdom as being famous, as people coming from all over, including kings and queens, to get counsel from Solomon on things like trees and agriculture. And so he knows a breadth of wisdom, and he knows the depth of wisdom, and it's a God-given wisdom. And look at verse 17. He pursued this wisdom all the way to madness and folly. This isn't nice, clean, neat, conventional wisdom. This isn't scholastic, academic, just like the teacher says, kind of wisdom. He gets crazy with knowledge, right? He's starting to experiment a little bit, we could say. He pursues things to the end of madness and folly, even in the realm of wisdom and knowledge. And so the conclusion is found in verse 18. He says this, because in much wisdom there is much grief, and increasing knowledge results in increasing pain. He says the more you know, the more you hurt. Instead of coming to the end of wisdom and knowledge and thinking there, now, there's satisfaction, he comes to the end of that road and says, the more you know, the more you hurt. Solomon apparently is the first guy to say ignorance is bliss. Not knowing is just better. Not knowing there's a hole in the ozone is fine. Not knowing what our national debt is, you know, whether it's in the trillions or gazillions today, is better than knowing and worrying. The more you know, the more worried you can become. So there's no hope in wisdom, he says. Thirdly, he pursues pleasure. The pursuit of pleasure. Chapter 2 unfolds this. And he starts out in verses 1 through 3 by listing some simple pleasures for us. Simple pleasures. He says, come now, I will test you with pleasure, so enjoy yourself, and behold, it too is futility. So he's giving us the answer right up front. But here's his pursuit. I said of laughter, it's madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely, and how to take hold of folly until I could see what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. Notice those last few phrases. Why is he pursuing this? He wants to find out what you're supposed to do while you're here. If you have 70, 80, 90 years, it's relatively short. It has to be for a reason. And if the reason is just chance, it's just because some amoeba popped up somewhere and I spun from that eventually generations and generations later, and here I am today, then again you have to ask, what's in it, what's it for, what are you supposed to do? So the meaning of life is not something that's religious. The question of the meaning of life is not something for Christians or Bible thumpers. It's something that probably plagues you and should plague you. Because the circumstances of life are pointing to this thing. They're scratching this itch. They're opening up this wound that's sometimes uncomfortable to have exposed. The simple pleasures, verse 2, he talks about laughter. He just got done talking about wisdom, and the more you know, the more you hurt, the more you worry. And so one of the simple pleasures is laughter. Let's forget about our cares and our worries. He says, hire Seinfeld. Get the Seinfeld reruns and keep watching them. Keep the laugh track going. Let's be distracted about the reality of pains and hurts and tough questions, and let's just keep the comedies coming. Nothing wrong with a good comedy. But the point here is when it is in pursuit for distraction only, and when we're not asking the biggest questions, when laughter isn't put in its proper place in relationship to God, then it is emptiness. He says in verse 3, wine was pursued. That pursuit of being numb between the ears was given over in a very careful way. Notice, I explored how to stimulate my body with wine. He's looking for a high. He's looking for the buzz. Again, it's part of escapism. Just like comedy, too much wine will be an escapism for my problems. So Solomon so pessimistically is saying to us, life is so bad, possibly the answer is just escaping until it's done. Ignoring the problems and laughing. Drinking so much wine you forget about it until eventually it's done. Or folly, in verse 3. This is the pursuit of goofing off. And it's a serious pursuit. Isn't it a funny thing? It's an oxymoron to think of the serious pursuit of goofing off. That's exactly what Solomon's describing here. I gave myself over to folly, to goofing off, to, again, the distraction, to have fun. But it's not just these simple pleasures. If we're tempted to think that Solomon is just a poor chap with a drug addiction, with alcoholism, just a guy who likes comedies too much, and if only he could taste and see refined pleasures, then maybe there would be hope for him and maybe he would be satisfied. Maybe for some of us, we know the answer is not in a bottle and it's not in a TV show and it's not just in a life of goofing off. We have moved up the satisfaction scale a little bit and now our pleasures are a little more refined. Maybe to put it in contemporary terms, to put it in very Albuquerquean terms, maybe we could very rawly say, the answer isn't in the ghetto, it's in the Tanawan community, right? Nothing wrong with Tanawan, and there's nothing wrong with the ghetto. The difference is different kinds of pleasures. And Solomon, though rich and though wise, hasn't given himself to upper class pleasures or lower class pleasures alone. He's run the gamut of all kinds of pleasures. So these refined pleasures in verses 4 through 8 look like this. I built houses in verse 4. And he didn't just build houses haphazardly. He didn't do small houses. He didn't use stucco. He used the real stuff. He does landscapes. Some of you get into landscaping, and I suppose the more you have, the more opportunity there is to get extravagant with these landscapes. And you know Solomon did that as well. In verse 7 and 8, he describes his possessions of slaves and animals and treasures. Look at verse 8. I collected for myself silver and gold and the treasures of kings. I provided for myself male and female singers. So he provides for himself entertainment. But literally the Hebrew here is, I collected for myself singers. Collected for myself singers. It's not that he goes to the Neil Diamond concert. He owns Neil Diamond. If you want to own Neil Diamond. It's not that he occasionally puts on a CD. He has the height of putting on a CD. They come and perform before him. Whatever a venue would have paid, Solomon can double it. He has infinite money almost. So he has the wherewithal for the very best entertainment of the day. He's not short on any of this. Verse 8 describes women and sex as well. He had the pleasures of men, many concubines. 1 Kings 11 describes his woman situation. It says he had 700 wives. You think you've got it hard, guys? Princesses and 300 concubines in his wives turned his heart away. So he's got infinite sex. I'm sure a few of these 1,000 or so ladies are pretty. He's got plenty of female eye candy walking around the temple, the places to live, the homes he's living in. He's enjoying himself in every way. So whatever road you think, if I go down that road, maybe to the end of it I would find fulfillment. Maybe a little bit further. Maybe we, like Rockefeller, when asked how much is enough, said, just a little bit more. Think that just a little bit more of fill in the blank, whatever your cup of tea is, then you would be satisfied. He even has fame, according to verse 9. Verse 9 says, he's great, and his fame increased more than all who preceded him in Jerusalem. The height of his fame is seen in 1 Kings 10, when the Queen of Sheba, we use that phrase today, someone who thinks there's something special, we call them, the Queen of Sheba. Well, the Queen of Sheba, the real Queen of Sheba, in 1 Kings 10, comes to pay homage to Solomon and get some advice from him. And she says, I heard about your wisdom and I heard about your riches, but the seeing and the experience of it all is incomparable to what I heard. So his fame has gone out in all the world. In other words, in every category, Solomon is wealthy, famous, achieving great things. He's built an empire such that Trump or Bill Gates can't hold a match to this guy. There's no celebrity who's doing as much and enjoying as much as Solomon was. How rich was Solomon? Well, he was so rich that his food in 1 Kings 4 is described like this. Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. One commentator estimates that this is enough for 35,000 people. This is one day's food. Well, he didn't eat it all, but it was there available to him. Every day they cooked up enough for 35,000 people so he could sample this and sample that and have whatever he wanted. And so, his worth is far beyond, it's inestimable, but it's far beyond anything of Bill Gates or Rockefeller or Trump. The temple would have been put in his assets column. The temple alone, in today's standards of gold and silver, would have been worth $1 trillion. So, riches, unlike we know. And hence the ability to pursue pleasure, unlike we know. And in case we're tempted to think that My satisfaction wouldn't be in accomplishments and working hard. My satisfaction would be in leisure. It may give me an eternal hammock, and I'm satisfied. Well, Solomon had that too. He inherits the kingdom when all the fighting is already done for Israel. He inherits the kingdom when there's peace on all sides. So 1 Kings 9 describes it as every man dwelling in the shade under his tree in Jerusalem. There's peace everywhere. It's the fulfillment of God's plan. The temple is now built. Solomon's the guy. It all came to its peak, even after David, in the son Solomon. And so there is much opportunity for pleasures of all sorts. And so verse 10 describes these unlimited pleasures. All my eyes desired, I did not refuse them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure. For my heart was pleased because of all my labor, and this was my reward for all my labor. Well, now we lead to some conclusions. Solomon will now backtrack and go over the same roads and tell us why their emptiness and futility and trying to grope for the wind. In chapter 2, verses 11 to 23, he gives us conclusions of emptiness. Conclusions of emptiness. Well, he states it as a summary in verse 11. I considered all my activities, which my hands had done, and the labor which I had exerted, and behold, all was vanity and striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. He describes the emptiness of wisdom in chapter 2, verses 12 to 17. He backtracks over wisdom to show why wisdom is ultimately unfulfilling. He's already done that in saying, the more you know, the more you worry. And so that doesn't help. But also he goes on to say, no matter how wise you get, in verse 15, the wise still die too. Even today, with all of the advances in the medical field, people still die. We can't solve the biggest problem, the biggest sickness, death. The death rate is still one out of one. Isn't that humbling for the sophisticated brain cancer doctor? It should be. And Solomon sees that early on, no matter how wise you get, you still die just like a dummy. There's no difference. He says, no one remembers the wise in verse 16. Oh, they might write about your theories in a book. But ultimately, people pass on and write new books and have new theories, and you vanish into ubiquity. Verse 17 says, all is emptiness then. Again, this all is empty, all is vanity, all is futility. Well, he goes on to describe the emptiness of labor in verses 18 to 20. In verse 18, he says this, I hated. Look how bad it's gotten. I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun. Why? For I must leave it to the man who will come after me. No matter how hard you work, you die and you have to leave it. The bumper sticker that says he who dies with the most toys wins should say he who dies with the most toys just dies. There are no U-Hauls behind Hearsts. No one packs for death. You can't take anything with you. Ladies, you got to leave your purses when you go. And Solomon says, it doesn't matter how much stuff you accumulate. You go through this small, narrow door where nothing fits except your soul when you die. That's the only thing that goes. And he says, I'm going to have to leave this to another, and who knows what the next guy's going to do with it. Instead of taking some pride in this heritage, and instead of taking some excitement in what he'll leave his children, he's actually despairing. I'll leave this all to my kids, but I don't know if they're going to blow it. I don't know if they're really going to use this wisely. I don't know if they're going to invest it. And so, when you really think about it, verse 20 says, when you really think through your labor, it shouldn't lead you to satisfaction in your labor by itself. It should lead you to despair. There's an emptiness in work. There's an emptiness in accomplishments. And we should know that. We should hear that lesson day in and day out. He also says, verses 21 to 23, there's an emptiness of accomplishments and possessions. No matter what you leave, You leave it to somebody else, and he again reiterates the same principle that what you work for, you might work hard to get, you might work hard to keep, but in the end you give it to somebody, and somebody will get it without having worked for it. And who knows what they will do with it. And so the more you work, the more you have, maybe, but the more you worry. Whether you work and get, or whether you work and spin your wheels your whole life, the more you work, the more you worry. Men, don't you know that? Haven't you experienced that? When the to-do list is bigger than usual and the pressure is harder at work than it has been, aren't you waking up like at 4 for no reason? It's not just a shrinking bladder. You just wake up and these problems are swimming in your head and you don't know what to do with them. The more you work, the more you might have, but the more you worry, verse 23 says. But then he moves on to give us some more hopeful conclusions of enjoyment. Conclusions of enjoyment. He tells us in verse 24, there is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. The first thing we should see here is that there's probably a better translation of verse 24. It says there's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. And that almost sounds despairing beyond words. It almost sounds like he's saying live the lie. Why don't you just pretend that it's good? It isn't good. It isn't enjoyable, but what else are you going to do? Well, it's slightly more hopeful than that. But he starts out by saying, I think a proper translation would be, there is no good innately in man than eating and drinking and telling himself that his labor is good. What he means by that is, there is nothing good within you that means food is satisfying and drink is satisfying. Food is great, but guess what? 4 hours later, you want another meal. Cheese tastes good and you enjoy that. But last week's cheese doesn't satisfy in the least. And so you know this principle that without God, by yourself, food plus Ryan doesn't equal satisfaction. There's no good innately within me that can bring about the result that food and drink just by itself brings happiness. And so verse 25 makes sense if we read it that way. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? That's the key. The hope is not in you and the hope is not in your circumstances. Your hope is in him. So the first point here is that nothing in us to enjoy life. There is nothing in us to enjoy life by ourselves. We're not supposed to fix this thing. We're supposed to go through this. We're supposed to see the futility. This is God's design. Back up to chapter 1 and verse 15. What is crooked cannot be straightened. Part of the problem is that we're trying to straighten out the futility of this life. When we're not supposed to, we're supposed to learn the lesson in the futility of this life. God is not frustrated wringing his hands up in heaven, wishing that somehow you could get fulfillment in things. Wishing somehow your job would start making sense to you. He has designed the emptiness of this life as a giant arrow that points you to him. He has designed the routine of eating so that every 4 hours you need more satisfaction as a giant arrow that points you to him. He has designed the redundancies of sleep and sunsets and water and hearing and seeing as a giant arrow that points you to something bigger. So God is in and behind the emptiness and futility. St. Augustine in the 5th century said, you have made us for yourself, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. Our hearts are restless. We know this in our lives, don't we? We see it in the lives of others. I watched a PBS program this week where it examined old people and their desires and looked at two different kinds. One being what's called nowadays, I guess, the youthful old. Have you heard of this category? These are old people that pretend they're not old. And the guy they highlighted was a Princeton scientist, partially responsible for putting the Hubble telescope up in space. He's 78 years old. He does rock climbing. I'm 29. I can't do rock climbing. And he wants to do some other kind of Hubble telescope in space before he dies that will even be bigger and better. And he said this. I wrote it down. It was so poignant for our Ecclesiastes series. He said, because the accomplishments of last decade do not satisfy today. I thought, oh, how sad. But he is speaking the language of Ecclesiastes so clear, so clearly indeed. It doesn't satisfy. No matter what your bag is, it doesn't satisfy. You're looking for another. You're looking for more. Why is it that drug addiction eventually seems to go in its worst possible form? Why is it that you start with maybe marijuana and eventually are on crack or something? Why is that? It's that better buzz. And it might be just a different kind of buzz when we trade cars out year after year, or when we switch homes, or when we're totally dissatisfied with last spring's wardrobe and need a full one this year. Or even just needing another CD, or another laugh, or another buzz. Well, in and through God, everything can be enjoyed. It's not that these things are bad. These things have one of two lessons for us every time we see them and partake of them. The things of life, all the things listed here from Solomon, except maybe concubines and many wives, are not bad things. They're things that, though, number one, can distract us. And when we seek to find our pleasure in these things and we come up short, it points us to God. But when we see these things as lenses to God, then He's glorified. These things can be enjoyed. The things of enchiladas and Cokes and Sunday afternoon football games can be happy times. And when they're not happy times, when you sense futility, when you're hoping for your team and your team didn't get it, or when you went to the restaurant and you searched for 15 minutes for the perfect meal and the person across from you got the perfect meal and you have the adequate meal, it points you to Ecclesiastes that it's got to be better than a meal. The PBS special also had the other category of people who aren't all about accomplishments at 78. They're all about retirement at 62. And so this was the Florida bunch. This was the shuffleboard, gin rummy, float in the pool, using fingertips. It was kind of funny. The guy had a big gut and just he looked like a human flotation device. And they're interviewing these folks, and one guy's hoping for the Hubble telescope to go up next year, another Hubble telescope, so that he'll find fulfillment because the last Hubble telescope accomplishment wasn't enough. And then these folks are satisfied with shuffleboard. Or so they say. Really? Shuffleboard? I mean, you worked hard 62 years or whatever for shuffleboard? This is as good as it gets? Push the disc. It's another one of those futility things, the endless cycle of redundancy. You push the chips down there, and guess what? They come on back. And this happens all year in Florida. And I'm not making fun of anyone's grandmother. I'm just saying, doesn't all of this, from the 20-somethings obsessed with the latest gadget to a retiree obsessed with shuffleboard and gin rummy, this is it? This is it? You don't have anything better than that? The reason we're groping and the reason we're trying so many little things is because we were made for infinite satisfaction. And there's only infinite satisfaction in God through Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ in John 6 says, I'm the bread of life, and when you eat of me, you're full and satisfied. He said in John 4 to a woman who was finding fulfillment in all the wrong places, in a bunch of men, he said, "Come, drink of my water, and you'll never thirst again." Psalm 16:11 says, "In your presence is the fullness of joy, and at your right hand are pleasures forevermore." What is there on earth that gives full joy and forever pleasures? Every joy I know of on this earth is good and it fades. And God put the fade there on purpose to point us to something that doesn't fade. And it is the typical thing of sin. Sin, in essence, is making a God out of the fading things. And going to these things, not as a pair of glasses to point us to God in Jesus Christ, but you're going to these things as ends in and of themselves. And there your whole life, you found emptiness, haven't you? Hasn't it been like groping, grasping after the wind? Aren't you waiting for something else? The Bible says, in Jesus Christ, God is the answer because you were made for the infinite. And this changes everything so that now life is something to be enjoyed, not despised or despairing of. Now all of a sudden the things are pointers to an eternally great reality. And they lead ultimately to the presence of the Lord, where there is the fullness of joy and pleasures forevermore.